It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rivals is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rivals, the show about music beefs and feuds and long simmering resentments between musicians. I'm Steve.
And I'm Jordan. And we are back for the second of our two-part episode in honor of Eddie Van Halen, who died on October 6, 2020, at the age of 65. Last week, we looked at the relationship between Van Halen and David Lee Roth, and this week, we're going to go deep on the Sammy Hagar years. Yes, that's right. Van Hagar fans, rejoice. Get some cricket sound effects in there, I think.
Okay, I can tell that I guess I'm going to be the one in this episode who says nice things about Van Hagar. I don't relish this position. I feel like Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. I'm playing the defense attorney in this episode, but like this
Johnny
is the
Cochran.
Position I've been put into, and I accept it nonetheless. Look, I bought Van Hagar tapes as a kid. I still put on 5150 occasionally, and I let the power balladry of dreams wash over me like a fleet of blue angels. Please don't judge me too harshly.
They do have some good songs. And, you know, it's really interesting. There were discussions about whether to actually rename the band Van Hagar when Sammy joined, like basically as a way to preserve the Van Halen brand if it all went south. And the decision to carry on under their original name was definitely, you know, a practical one. And I'm sure they had, you know, dollar signs dancing in their heads and everything. But also, it was a giant middle finger to Dave, because bands tend to get held hostage by their lead singers and frontman. We saw this with Bernie Sumner and New Order, because, you know, they're viewed as justifiably the one member of the band you really can't replace, unless you're in a band called Van Halen, and you are one of the Van Halens. So in this case, they bucked this trend with a new lead singer, and I don't know, aside from AC/DC or maybe Black Sabbath or Genesis, I can't really think of another band that achieved that much success with a new singer. Not just as a replacement, but as a way forward. And it's just so fascinating to me because this was such a hugely successful era for the band. I mean, all their albums went to number one, but it just seems to be universally looked down upon by Van Halen fans, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not cool to say you like Van Hagar. I mean, you look at Van Halen with David Lee Roth in the band, and they're just like one of the most fun, infectious, like badass American rock bands ever. And then with Sammy Hagar, they just took this sort of adult contemporary turn towards power ballads. You know, I mentioned Dreams before. You also had songs like Right Now and like Love Walks In and When It's Love. Lots of songs with love in the title. But yeah, I think it's worth noting that like the change with Hagar occurred at a time in the band's trajectory when I think they needed to grow up a bit or risk turning into a caricature. And like it or not, Sammy Hagar brought them into a more mature era. Which is kind of crazy, given that Sammy Hagar is a guy who drinks tequila all day and writes songs about the time he was abducted by aliens.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy Buffett meets Guy Fieri. You kind of get, like, Sammy Hagar vibes there. I mean, yeah, he seems awesome. But, yeah, the Van Halen, Van Hagar debate is one for the ages. It's something that's pitted brother against brother and torn apart marriages. It's something we'll get to later on this episode, comparing the two incarnations of the band. But for now, we'll focus on Sammy versus the other members of Van Halen. So Hope you have your bottle of Cabo Wabo handy.
Yeah, Sammy might seem like a laid-back guy, but he actually had a pretty bitter fight with Van Halen after he left the band and then when he left the band again. So I'm excited to get into it. So without further ado, let's get into this mess.
So there's an alternate universe where Sammy Hagar was actually always part of Van Halen, which, you know, mind blown there. When the band were recording their first record in 1977, the producer, Ted Templeman, came into the studio with an album he'd produced by Sammy's former band, Montrose, and effectively said, you know, we're going to make an album like this. He wanted to give Van Halen's record that big rock candy sound. And Eddie was totally cool with this. He was a huge Montrose fan, so he thought it was fine as a blueprint. And it's interesting to note here that Sammy was sort of, was a decade older than the guys in Van Halen. So he's kind of part of the generation that inspired the band. And like I said, Eddie was heavily influenced by Ronnie Montrose as a guitarist, particularly his use of big open chords, those big crunchy guitar chord sounds that Van Halen used. So Templeman went even further to suggest that they hire Sammy, who by that point was thrown out of Montrose. And it doesn't seem likely that the band ever seriously considered this, but it's definitely an alternate universe thing I like to consider from time to time.
Yeah, it would have been interesting if Hagar was in the band originally. I don't think they would have been Van Halen. I don't think they would have been as successful as they ultimately were with Roth. Of course, we'll never know. But I mean, we talked about this last week, just the magic that Roth and Eddie Van Halen had together, that was really kind of based on diametrically opposed personalities. And it just created this tension that put out sparks and created this kind of special alchemy that resulted in the Van Halen that we all know and love on those first six albums. While Van Halen is like rising to, you know, being one of the biggest bands in America, Sammy Hagar is actually taking like a much, I guess, more workmanlike path through his career. He's known as this guy who's like never like the most like popular person on the radio. He's not often like the headliner at his shows, but he's a worker. He's someone that like puts in the time to entertain the audience. In a way, he's as much of a showman as David Lee Roth, but whereas David Lee Roth is very much like the rock star in the gilded cage, you know, like the exotic bird type rock star, Sammy Hagar is like the everyman rock star. He's the guy that you look on stage and you think, oh, I could be that guy. And he's also someone who's really good at schmoozing, you know, program directors at radio stations and tour promoters. And he becomes this person that is like really popular in the industry that, you know, people want to give him a chance. So by the mid-80s, he's actually achieving like the greatest success of his career. He puts out that song, I Can't Drive 55. It's a big hit. It's the song I think that's still most associated with him as a solo artist. And he puts out his first platinum record, which is called VOA, which is short for Voice of America. Have you ever heard that album, by the way?
My only frame of reference for that album, aside from I Can't Drive 55, is Dick in the Dirt. Because
yes.
My father's name is Dick, so I got endless amusement from that track.
Oh, man. Well, I would think that your dad, you know, all due respect to your dad, if you're called Dick, there's like lots of other references that you could also make to that name.
Yes.
I would think. So it's not just on Sammy Hagar that you were tortured for that. But yeah, Dick in the Dirt is from VOA. And that album, it is this mix of like patriotic songs. Like on the cover of the album, Sammy Hagar is parachuting onto the lawn in front of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. Because, like, Sammy Hagar is, like, I think he was a
what
big fan
mean?
Of Rome.
I don't understand even what that means
I
by that.
The idea was, like, you know, there was, like, a lot of, like, sort of anti-Russian sentiment at the time. I think that he was, like a soldier rocker type thing. And he was a big fan of Ronald Reagan. Like, and Sammy Hagar generally has been known to be lean on the politically conservative side of the spectrum. And so, yeah, he's writing these, like, sort of, like, patriotic songs, or he's writing, like, really dumb sex songs. And this is going to be something that he will, of course, eventually take to Van Halen, where I always feel like that's the difference between him and David Lee Roth. We talked about this a little bit last week, where I feel like David Lee Roth, he could write these dumb sex songs, but there was always like a wink and a nod in there where, again, you feel like he was in on his own joke. Like he was acknowledging the seediness of it, the ridiculousness of it. Whereas Sammy Hagar writes a song like Dick in the Dirt, and it's an earnest song. He's actually serious about his dick being in the dirt. I mean, that is the difference between those two guys, like a smart guy who acts dumb in the case of David Lee Roth and a guy who maybe just is kind of dumb, but likable in the case of Sammy Hagar. So we get to the mid-80s. Sammy Hagar is riding high as a solo act. Meanwhile, Van Halen, they need a new lead singer after David Lee Roth exits the band to become a movie star, which of course never happens. And they go through a couple different singers. They go to Patti Smyth, the singer from Scandal, who had a big hit at the time called The Warrior. That was like a big radio hit in the mid-80s. She said no. Apparently, they approached Daryl Hall of Hall & Oates to be the lead singer of Van Halen, which just seems insane. Daryl Hall is a great singer, but more of a blue-eyed soul type singer. I don't really see him being the frontman of Van Halen. And of course, he didn't either. He said no. There's actually a story recently that Steve Perry from the band Journey was approached by Eddie Van Halen about possibly being a singer in the band, which I think is interesting given the direction that Van Halen was going in, which I think was more akin to Journey than the early records of Van Halen were. They were moving in more of that kind of middle of the road direction. But Steve Perry said no, he was already in a successful band. So then he gets hooked up with Sammy Hagar because the mechanic for his Lamborghini suggested Sammy Hagar, which is the most mid-80s rock dude thing ever. It's like the Lamborghini mechanic.
Right. I mean, Sammy brought his car in because he's like, hey, I can't drive 55. Can you fix this, please? Like, I need someone to fix this car.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, that's amazing. But I guess Eddie took his mechanic suggestion and put in a call to Sammy, and they arranged an audition at Eddie's studio at his house, 5150 Studios. And it was basically something approaching Love at First Sight. I guess the song Summer Nights came out of their first jam session. And in his memoir, Sammy compared the sound to his favorite band, Cream. He said this was something about the sound that was slow, confident, almost majestic. My rock had always been more intense, but they relaxed into this groove thing. Even if it was up-tempo, I decided I was in. And the band loved Sammy because he could provide rhythm guitar, which Dave hadn't been able to do. But moreover, they felt he was a better singer. And Alex would even say, it's like driving a Porsche after years of owning a Volkswagen.
Oh, man.
That's brutal.
Yeah, like it's the most colorful and high-kicking Volkswagen of all time, if it is a Volkswagen. I don't think that's a real fair comparison, Alex Van Halen. I think another thing that's important, too, is that Eddie Van Halen and Sammy Hagar became fast friends. Yeah. Like they actually genuinely liked each other personally. I think they lived like on the same stretch of beach in Malibu. Like they had beach houses, like it was like one over from each other. So I think in the early days, like Eddie Van Halen would like be playing guitar on his porch and he would like walk over to Sammy Hagar's house and they would write songs that way, which is never a relationship they had that existed between David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen. Those guys were never close. So I think there was like a genuine sort of personal bond there. But of course, no matter how good they might have felt about each other at the time, it was risky for Van Halen to bring in a new lead singer. And, you know, you said this earlier, they were thinking about maybe changing the name. There was this concern that this was going to blow up in everyone's faces. But when the record company heard the songs that they were working on 5150, I think especially the song Why Can't This Be Love, the head of the band's label, Mo Austin, said, "I smell money." What's the quote when he heard that song, which again, extremely mid-80s, just like a sleazy like record label thing to say, even though Mo Austin is held in pretty high esteem in the record industry. But just the idea, like they heard this song and they're like, oh yeah, like this band is going to be huge. And of course, that song ended up being a huge hit from the record. I think it was like a top five song on the pop charts. And of course, 5150 went through the roof when it was released. And, you know, you listen to 5150 and I think a lot of fans like that, you know, love the Roth era, they were really turned off by 5150 because it did have this sort of corporate rock sound. Like I likened them to Journey earlier. The producer of that record is this guy, Mick Jones, who played in the band Foreigner. So, you know, it has, again, like, it feels more like Journey, Foreigner, you know, REO Speedwagon, like bands of that ilk than like the hard charging party band of old. But again, I have to say that, like, I mean, Sammy Hagar is certainly a part of that, but I think he's somewhat of a scapegoat here because the fact of the matter is that Eddie Van Halen was writing this music. Like, he wanted to move in this direction. And I think, obviously, like, with the success of Jump, that proved that putting synths on a Van Halen song would be very commercial. And I think there's a pretty natural progression from that to 5150, which is, like, pretty heavy on the synths.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all the way back to Diver Down. I mean, it's something that it seems like Dave was the one who was primarily against it. With him gone, he could really indulge in that. And also, Sammy was a guitarist, too. So on stage, for all the songs that, you know, needed guitar parts, Sammy could play that, and then it would allow free Eddie up to play more of those parts, too. So I think it definitely allowed him to expand further down that route, too, because not only were people not objecting to it anymore, but also just from a practical standpoint on stage, he was able to do that more and allow that to be more part of the band's live sound.
I have to do a quick sidebar on the song Love Walks In, which I think is like one of the better power ballady songs from 5150. Sammy Hagar wrote that song about aliens, and he's written like a bunch of songs about aliens. And like, I don't know if you've read like his memoir, Red, which came out, I think, about 10 years ago. It's like an underrated memoir. People don't talk about it in like when they talk about the great memoirs of recent years, but
there are some haunting lines in that, I have to say, especially later on about with Eddie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the stuff about Eddie Van Halen is great, but like just Sammy Hagar is like such a weirdo. Like, and he's a fascinating guy. I actually interviewed him when he put that book out, and he was a great interview. I think we talked for like almost 90 minutes. Like,
oh,
he,
man.
Like, he is this guy. He's a good storyteller, and he's just like this eccentric dude. And he writes in his book about how he actually like met aliens when he was a kid. Like, there's this passage in the book. He says, "I was lying in bed one night dreaming. I saw a ship and two creatures inside of the ship. I couldn't see their faces. I just knew that there were two intelligent creatures sitting up in a craft in the Little Creek Forest area at about 12 miles away in the foothills above Fontana." He's talking about Northern California here. "And they were connected to me, tapped into my mind through some sort of mysterious wireless connection."
They downloaded his thoughts. That's like what he always said. It's amazing.
And I think that the implication here, too, is that like the aliens helped to set him on this path toward rock and roll greatness.
Yeah, he's been saying in interviews, like, "They taught me some things that really helped me in life," was that he would always say, that he learned from them. And he named his publishing company after them. He said that they were from the ninth dimension, and he named his music publishing Nine Music in their honor.
And he actually said that, like, he wanted to write more about aliens in his book, but his co-author, Joel Selvin, was like, "No one wants to hear about the aliens."
I do.
Exactly. And he was like, "I could write a whole book about aliens." And I was like,
"He should.
Please do that. That would be amazing." Because, like, honestly, the Montrose stuff, it's kind of interesting. But, like, aliens downloading thoughts into your brain with a wireless connection, you know, many decades before the internet, I'm into that. So, yeah. You know, the song Love Walks In is about that.
Did he talk more about that to you?
We delved into it a little bit, not as much as I would like. I think, again, like, he's sort of into talking about it, but also feels like maybe I should be promoting my book and not this transcendent experience I had with extraterrestrials.
That's more in line with his brand, I guess. You're right. So that is Sammy brings a lot to the band. He brings his guitar playing. He brings his alien experiences. And, of course, he brings his voice, which, you know, I don't think anyone can argue, even though I am more pro Roth than pro Hagar. Much stronger voice than Roth. I mean, he's a real singer. I mean, no disrespect to Roth, but he, as you said in the last episode, is more of like a scat singing kind of proto rapper kind of. He's not a singer, you know, and I think that with having Sammy there, Eddie was able to write, expand his range even greater, not only into the keyboard realm, but write the kind of songs that David would never really be able to sing.
Yeah, and again, I go back to that story about Steve Perry being approached by Eddie Van Halen about, and Steve Perry has said that, like, "I'm not clear on whether he was inviting me to join the band or if he just wanted to jam." But when you look at Steve Perry or Patti Smyth or Daryl Hall, these other singers that came up as possible replacements, they are all just sort of classically like great singers. Like, you would look at them and say, like, "Oh yeah, those people can sing anything." And it does seem that, like, Eddie Van Halen, that was something that he wanted at the time. And it seems like it was more in tune, again, with the music that he was writing. Again, I think that if you don't like Van Hagar, to define the band purely by him, I think for Eddie Van Halen would be offensive, because we talked about this last week, that he didn't like it when people split the band into different eras according to the lead singer, because to him, it's like, "I'm the common denominator. I'm the auteur of this band. It's all Van Halen music. These guys are just sort of coming in and out of the band." And I think if you look at the band that way, which is, I don't think most people look at it that way. They look at the singers as being almost like the protagonists in Van Halen. But if you look at it as Eddie Van Halen being the protagonist, it's pretty clear that he makes this progression from the party rock of the late 70s to more of this, again, corporate rock, adult contemporary sound into the late 80s. And as much as I think we all prefer the Roth era, I think it does make sense in a commercial sense and also an aesthetic sense that they would make that evolution. Because if you still have David Lee Roth in the band in like 1988 or 1990 or 1995, that would have been a pretty dated band. I think it would have been harder for them to do what Van Halen did, which was be one of the only bands of their era to continue to be successful, you know, into the late 80s and then into the alternative rock era of the 90s. And Sammy Hagar certainly wasn't hip, and they were not an alternative band, but I think there was maybe something a little bit more, shall we say, dignified about this era of Van Halen. Like, as weird as it is to say that about them, but like, they just seemed more like an older band with him in the band, and maybe that was more appropriate for this era.
Yeah, it allowed them to sort of instantly mature. I mean, not only for their own reputation, I mean, you can't be pushing 40 and doing the kind of things that David Lee Roth was, but also their sound, too. I mean, the sound of rock from the late 80s to the early 90s is such a massive shift from like the tail end of hair metal, which was basically people trying to be Van Halen, but to the nth degree, to stuff like grunge, which leads you to their album Balance, which I always thought was kind of Van Halen's take on doing a grunge album.
Yeah, it definitely feels that way. Like there's that the lead single, Don't Tell Me What Love Can Do, which was supposedly inspired by Kurt Cobain's suicide. And you listen to the guitar and it does feel, I guess, grungy. It feels so strange to apply that adjective to Eddie Van Halen's guitar tone, because I just think of his guitar tone as just being inherently bright and hot. You know, it's not sludgy, really. And it's not really sludgy on that song, but I think like in the realm of Van Halen, this was like a relatively like angry, moody record. And this record comes out in 1995, and there was a four-year gap between this album and the previous record, which was For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, that came out in the spring of 91, comes out really before grunge has become a big thing. Like, Nevermind and 10 are going to come out a little bit later in 91. So Van Halen kind of got under the wire there. And again, like Balance, it ended up debuting at number one, so it's their fourth consecutive number one record. But I know, like, for me, like, as someone, again, I was buying Van Hagar tapes as like a 10, 11-year-old. You know, I had dropped out of Van Halen by the time of Balance because they just maybe didn't seem quite like they were of the era. And it also seemed like Van Halen was falling apart a little bit. Like, I don't know if you've seen like clips of them performing at this time, but like they look pretty beat up. Like, this was around the time that Alex Van Halen was like playing with a neck brace on stage all the time, which like I hate to laugh because he was in pain at the time, but like whenever I see the neck brace, I always think of like those legal shows like where the person is pretending to be injured and they're wearing the neck brace and then like they take it off and like, you know,
play a drum solo.
Yeah, they take it off and it's proven that they're faking it or something. Yeah. It's always like this. I always associate neck braces with comedy, I guess. So to see him on stage with a neck brace, it's just so bizarre. And of course, Eddie Van Halen was having his issues with his hip, where it was hard for him to move around on stage. So they're falling apart physically. And then, of course, they're also starting to have tension, finally, with Sammy Hagar. Again, like, him and Eddie were legitimate friends for a long time, but it seems like around this time, the tension that derived from the relationship seemed to be that, like, Eddie Van Halen was, like, a workaholic, always in his home studio 5150 recording, whereas Sammy Hagar, again, he's drinking tequila all day long, he's got the flip-flops on, he's got the baggy shorts.
The Oakley's glasses.
He's like becoming the Jimmy Buffett of heavy metal, essentially, at this time. And he's just a much more easygoing guy. And it seemed like maybe Eddie looked at Sammy as being lazy.
Right. I mean, also, it sounds like there was a lot of musical differences during the recessions for Balance, too. I mean, he would say that this was the era when Sammy would say, you know, that was the record where if I said black, Eddie said white. And if I said, okay, white, he'd say, no, I want black. And then he'd say, okay, well, I wanted black to begin with. And then Eddie would go, well, I don't know what I want, but I'll let you know when I do. He just wanted the opposite what Sammy wanted. That's what he said in years later, too. So it's definitely spilled over into the creative realm, too. All right, hang on. We'll be right back with more Rivals.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Minnie Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
I don't understand what the big fat ones are. You don't put those inside of you, do you? I mean, you do?
Yes. This is a show about women.
Okay, so I just reapply my lip gloss after eating a delicious lunch. We are headed back now to European Political Systems class at Baruch College. Woo!
Finally, a show about women that isn't just a thinly veiled aspirational nightmare. That's it. That's actually the name of the show. It's not hosted, not narrated. We're just dropping into a woman's world. It's like reality TV on the radio.
I found out when my dad was gay when I was 10. We were in a convertible on the 405 freeway, listening to the B-52s. And looking back, I should have said, this is gay. This is already all gay.
Listen to Finally a Show on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And then things really come to a head, weirdly enough, during sessions for the Twister soundtrack, which, like, you know, there was chaos going on screen and also chaos behind the scenes, apparently.
Well, yeah, because the band's longtime manager, who joined right when Sammy joined, had just died. And they got a new manager who was also Alex's brother-in-law. And he was doing what a manager did, which come up with a lot of ways to make a lot of money very quickly. Some would call these schemes canny. Others would call them kind of crass and cheap. And one of his plans was to do a song for the Twister soundtrack, but it was supposed to be done when the band were on a break. It was supposed to be after their Balance tour in 1996. And everybody really needed some downtime, especially Sammy, who had just gotten married and his wife was about to have a baby. And he wanted to go be with her. And I guess they were planning to have the baby out in Hawaii, have a natural birth out in Hawaii. And so he got roped back in to do these sessions for Twister. And not only did he have to go work, he had to go fly across the Pacific back to Eddie's house. So it's not bad enough that he had to, like, move. Eddie just has to go into his backyard. Sammy has to fly across the Pacific to leave his wife, his pregnant wife, to go do these songs. And the sessions were really tense. They were trying to write multiple songs, and they weren't coming together. So they just did one song called, I think it's called Human Beings, which I have to say, I played once.
It's not called Human Beings. It's called Humans Being, which is a terrible title.
Oh,
I don't understand. It's called Humans Being because Human Beings, that makes sense. That's why you thought it was called that.
Right.
But it was called Humans Being, like, for which I don't know what that has to do with tornadoes. But apparently when there's a tornado in the vicinity, you can't properly title a song. Like, that's something, it just causes your brain to blank out. But yeah, they're trying to write multiple songs, but that was the only one that they could finish.
Right. And then, so they finish it. He goes back to Hawaii. And then they get a call from Eddie. Oh, man, we actually got to do a second one. Can you come back? And Sammy's like, no, my wife's about to have a baby. I'm not. So they end up putting an instrumental on the album to fulfill their commitment for a second song on there, too. But that's really a major line in the sand for them is, ironically, the Twister soundtrack, which I believe, I could be wrong, is what brought Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks back together.
That's
in
96 right.
too, right? Yeah.
Oh, man. So this Twister soundtrack, bringing people together, also tearing them apart. This is like the most momentous classic rock-related album of the 90s, I think.
What an oral history on the Twister soundtrack.
So there's issues over the Twister soundtrack. Sammy Hagar, I think with justification, felt like, I don't really have time for this. Again, my wife is having a difficult birth. I want to be with her. But Eddie and Alex are looking at him as not being a team player, essentially. They don't feel like he's contributing his fair share to the band. And this gets compounded when the Greatest Hits album for Van Halen comes up. And this ends up being tense for multiple reasons, because not only are the Van Halen brothers trying to get Sammy in the studio to record a couple new songs for this Greatest Hits album, but they're also working with David Lee Roth. And they haven't told Sammy Hagar that they're working with David Lee Roth on these songs. And when he hears about this, of course, he's going to hit the roof. So that is a big issue in the band. But from the Van Halen brothers' perspective, they were really feeling a lot of frustration because they were having trouble getting Sammy to work on these songs. Meanwhile, 2 years before this, Sammy Hagar had put out his own greatest hits record called Unboxed, which, by the way, who's buying a Sammy Hagar greatest hits album? Who's buying this? You need more songs than I Can't Drive 55? That's all you need. I guess this was the 90s and you couldn't download songs, you couldn't stream songs. So people were like, I love I Can't Drive 55 so much, I'm going to spend $18.99 on a Sammy Hagar greatest hits record. Maybe you end up...
Was there Montrose stuff on there?
I am not familiar with the Sammy Hagar greatest hits record, I must say. I guess I'm hoping maybe Dick in the Dirt is on that record.
Yes.
All apologies to your father, of course. But the Van Halen brothers look at this, and Sammy Hagar had recorded a couple extra songs for that album, essentially because the record company was going to give him extra money for that, and he was getting divorced at the time, and he just like took that money and gave it to his ex-wife. So it was just a pure sort of like divorce settlement type thing. Shades of Here, My Dear, I guess, only now instead of a masterpiece,
oh, yes,
it's a shitty Sammy Hagar greatest hits album. But the Van Halen brothers look at this and they just see Sammy Hagar again not being a team player and also being a bit of a hypocrite, because you did it for your greatest hits record. This is for a Van Halen greatest hits record that people actually care about, and you're not contributing.
Yeah, and Sammy would say, like, this project is where all the bad blood really started. And the details of their final split are disputed, but it's apparently it ended with a phone call on Father's Day, which is very fitting considering the issues of Sammy wanting to be there for his wife's birth. On Father's Day, 1996. And in Eddie's version, he called Sammy and basically read on the Riot Act. Like, you know, if you want to make another record and do another tour, you have to be a team player. Van Halen is a band, not the Sammy Hagar show. And Sammy apparently responded by saying, you know, I'm frustrated. I want to go back to being a solo artist. And he said, all right, well, fine. Like, thank you for being honest. And his version of the story, at least, said, you know, with minimal fury, said, well, go back and go do that. And we're going to do our own thing. So according to Eddie, Sammy quit in an egotistical huff because he wanted to go do his own thing rather than sublimate his artistic vision with Van Halen. Sammy, as you might expect, disputes this version. He basically says that he was fired. And then, you know, adding insult to injury, they turned around really quickly and got Dave back into the mix, too, which... For him, he said, that was worse than sleeping with the enemy. We bumped heads, and the next thing I know, Eddie calls and David Lee Roth is back. And that's the end of Van Halen.
Yeah, it seems like there's like some timeline confusion here, because I've heard stories that Van Halen were working with David Lee Roth on these tracks for the Greatest Hits album. Again, because the idea was that they were going to record a couple songs with him and a couple songs with Sammy Hagar to represent both eras of the band. But Sammy Hagar makes it sound like they contacted Roth after Hagar left. And then
maybe they kept it from him for fear of him like freaking out.
So it's not really clear. I mean, to me, like what this really speaks to is for all the success that Van Hagar had, I feel like Sammy Hagar always had a bit of insecurity about David Lee Roth. And that really manifested itself in their concerts because he wouldn't perform David Lee Roth songs in the show. And I think his idea was that, you know, this is a new band. I want to, you know, stay true to this era. I want to stay true to our songs. Obviously, Van Hagar was very successful. So, you know, they had hits of their own. They didn't necessarily have to play the older songs. But I feel like that might have backfired on him because, you know, look, if you love Van Halen, you want to hear Running with the Devil, you want to hear Ain't Talking About Love, you want to hear Panama. And the fact that like they never played those songs with Hagar, I think it just created like a mythology about that period that like made people really pine for that. Like, what if Hagar had just sung those songs and like people thought, wow, like these songs sound even better with Sammy Hagar, or they sound as good with Sammy Hagar? I just think that at some point maybe people wouldn't have felt so much affection for the Roth era if Hagar hadn't sort of like blocked it out or tried to block it out so completely from his years in Van Halen. I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, didn't Roth do the same thing too? But people basically said like he just didn't have the chops to sing Hagar songs. But I feel like Roth sort of did the same thing and refused to sing the Hagar era
songs.
It's
different
too
with him though. I think that like if you're going to see like the Roth era Van Halen, you just want to hear that. I don't want to hear David Lee Roth sing.
You want to pretend it's 1980.
Yeah, I don't want to hear him sing Love Walks In. And talking about aliens. That's like the Sammy Hagar alien song. I want to hear David Lee Roth do the Roth era stuff. I think the onus was on Hagar to like plant his flag in the Roth era and say, hey, I can perform these songs as well as he can, which I don't think, by the way, he could have. I think their styles are so different that like hearing Sammy Hagar do like the David Lee Roth shtick, you know, like, you know, ease the seat back, that whole Panama rap, you know, that would have been weird. You know, he wouldn't have done it as well. But I just feel like that he did that, I think, so people wouldn't compare the two versions of the band. But I think in a way he sort of like inadvertently exacerbated it.
I wonder how much Eddie was involved with that, though, too. Like, I wonder if he said, you know what? No, new era. Like, we're going to do my new songs. Like, I wonder, like, whose decision that fully
it's
was.
It's possible. I just feel like he probably would have done it. And I remember I read Ian Christie's book, Everybody Wants Some, which is a great biography of Van Halen. And the sense I got from that book is that, especially like towards the end of Van Hagar, that like he was itching to play some of those songs again because they're great songs. And I'm sure he knew that if he played Ain't Talking About Love, that like he's going to burn down any arena in the world, you know, like people are going to be so excited to hear that. But be that as it may, Hagar leaves the band, I think kind of hastily. You know, this exit to me doesn't make as much sense as Roth leaving. Like they're arguing about a greatest hits album and the Twister soundtrack. It seems very petty to me. Like, whereas I feel like Roth was clearly growing apart from Van Halen, but like Hagar, again, Hagar and Van Halen were actually pals. And to blow up the band over this, it just seems sort of silly to me.
Yeah, I mean, he seemed to have a lot of remorse and regret over it all, like not that long after. So, you know, if I knew that my making a greatest hits album, the Unboxed album, was going to do this to the band, I wouldn't be in Van Halen anymore, I never would have done it. Like, he seems genuinely sad about all this, which I don't think Dave ever was throughout the 80s. I mean, Dave was in the wings, kind of like a WWF fighter, trash-talking Sammy every chance he could in the press, saying, like, you know, there's a singer, Sammy Hagar is a singer, but I'm the singer, was, I think, one of his great quotes. So, like, you know, so Dave never really had that kind of regret, I don't think. Whereas Sammy seemed very quickly, like, very sad about all this.
In the short run, though, he did take some shots at the Van Halen brothers. And, of course, like, his book, Red, is, like, brutal to both of them, but especially Eddie Van Halen. But in the short run, you know, in 1997, he puts out this solo record called Marching to Mars, which is another alien reference, I guess. And the album kicks off with a song called Little White Lie, which is him basically just, like, venting about what he sees again as the Van Halen brothers stabbing him in the back, you know, sleeping with the enemy, as it were, by working with David Lee Roth. Also, like that album, it ends with a song called Both Sides Now, which is not the Joni Mitchell song, although it'd be hilarious if it were, if he sang the Joni Mitchell song. But like that song is, you know, it's like he vented his spleen on the first track, but now he's like a little bit more reflective. And there's the line in the song where he says, yeah, we got to learn how to listen before we learn how to talk. We got to learn how to crawl before we learn to walk. If you want a little peace, sometimes you got to fight. We got to walk through the darkness before we stand in the light. Oh, yeah. That's about as philosophical as Sammy Hagar gets in his lyrics. You can feel like that regret, I think, a little bit there. That, okay, maybe, you know, we could have talked this out. Like, we had a great thing going. Maybe just take a breather and then come back. But instead, we've just blown up this hugely profitable band.
My favorite part about that album, too, is that he gets Slash in to play. I think it was on Little White Lie, actually, the song where he's venting his spleen. And I always thought that was a message. Like, you know what? Because this was when Slash was on the outs with Axl. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get my own guitar god, Eddie, and my own guitar god who hates his lead singer. And, like, you know, see, I feel like that was just, like, sort of openly replacing him in a small way on that song. Like, look, like, we can
and
do
David
this.
David Lee Roth tried the same thing when he brought in Steve Vai on his early solo records.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, yeah, everyone is always just trying to replace Eddie Van Halen, which, of course, you cannot do. Like, Eddie Van Halen is Eddie Van Halen. And I got to say, too, that, like, the Van Hagar records, you know, even if, like, Sammy Hagar isn't your cup of tea, there is still, like, some pretty great Eddie Van Halen guitar and Alex Van Halen drums on those records. Like, I was listening to OU812, which is an album as dumb as that album title, basically. But, like, if you just listen to the instrumental tracks, there's, like, some hot playing on that record. Same with For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. Like, there's some, like, terrible lyrics. Like, the song Sucker in a Three-Piece from OU812. So stupid. Or Black and Blue, which, you know, you can just tell from the title that's just like a gross sex song. But, you know, those guys could play and they could elevate even like terrible lyrics. Whereas like on Marching to Mars, I don't know if Slash can like elevate Sammy Hagar's terrible lyrics in the same way that Eddie Van Halen can.
No. Yeah, I mean, well, also, we haven't mentioned Powder Cake yet, which is one of my favorite songs from the Van Hagar era.
Oh, man.
Or Pound Cake.
Yeah, Pound Cake. Exactly. Pound Cake. Stupid. Stupid title, stupid lyrics, but pretty like rockin' music. So, you know, that was always the case, I think, with Van Hagar, much more than with David Lee Roth, where I think like the lyrics and the music were working more in concert with each other. We talked about this last week, but there was the Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth tour that occurred in the early aughts, which was during this period. It was post the Gary Cherone era, where, you know, they put out Van Halen 3 in 1998, and that record just tanks. And Van Halen goes on hiatus for an extended period of time. Eddie Van Halen really kind of lapses into a dark period of alcoholism in the early aughts. And the idea, again, like, for this Hagar, David Lee Roth tour was that, like, I think it was partly to troll the Van Halen brothers, but I think also, I think certainly from Sammy Hagar's perspective, it was also to kind of goad them back into touring again.
Yeah, I can't tell if he knew that. I mean, he openly said, like, this was to piss off Alex and Eddie. So I know, I feel like almost that was at least 90% of it right there. That's my gut. It'd be nice to think if that actually was responsible for the 2004 reunion. Although when we get to the 2004 reunion, it was such a disaster that I'm sure he probably regretted that.
Yeah, I mean,
that.
I think like in the Ian Christie book, there's a bit in there about how like, I think Sammy Hagar felt like, oh, if I can just show them how many fans still want to like hear this music, that it will inspire them maybe to like get out of whatever funk they're in and get the band back together again. And as much of a train wreck in a lot of ways as that Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth tour was, it was like pretty successful. Like they played large venues, they sold a lot of tickets, and you know, whether it was directly responsible or not for the reunion, Sammy Hagar did end up back in the fold in 2004.
And this era is so dark. But it began with some good feelings. Like the detente was a phone call between Sammy and Alex Van Halen. And they encouraged him to stop by 5150 and jam a little bit and just kind of, you know, see if they could get the old magic back. And in Sammy's memoir, he describes, it's like, it's too bleak to even quote, this like really dark scene with Eddie that really descended in alcoholism. And he's walking around with like, you know, rope for a belt and like boots with like gaffer tape over him to cover the holes. And he's drinking wine out of a bottle and it's just rough, but he's still Eddie Van Halen. And Eddie and Alex start playing some music that they've been working on. And he says it just sounded great. He was really inspired by it. So they decided, you know what, we're going to start fresh. We're going to do this. We're going to rise above it. And they decided to make a new album. And it was supposed to be a full-length album. It was going to be called The Best of Both Worlds. And they recorded some songs. And they were, in a couple weeks, they recorded, I think, almost a full album's worth. And they were waiting for Eddie to put his guitar solos on it. And according to Sammy, at least, Eddie was just in no state to do it, and it was just taking him months to get these solos on, and it was just taking way too long. So instead, they decided to put out a Van Halen, or Van Hagar, I guess, era greatest hits album and put these new songs on it and tour.
I love that, like, Sammy Hagar in his book Red describes Eddie Van Halen as, quote, the weirdest fuck I've ever seen.
I mean, yeah, that's what he was at that era, I guess.
Yeah, he was just in rough shape. There's just terrible story that he tells in the book about how, you know, they were getting ready to go on the road in 04. And by the way, like, yeah, like those tracks that they recorded, I don't think they've ever been released, have they? I mean,
I don't think so.
And that's probably for the best, but there's this terrible story about how they were getting ready for the tour and like Eddie Van Halen was not in good shape. He was drinking a lot. And he says, according to Sammy Hagar at one point, he says, I will kill the first motherfucker that tries to take this bottle away from me. I left my family for this shit. You think I'm going to do it for you guys? Which is just, that is the darkest behind the music moment ever. But it just, yeah, it speaks to like how, you know, they're trying to get back on the road. Again, this is a very profitable brand. I mean, I remember that the expectations for this tour, even though it wasn't Roth, I mean, the Van Hagar, I think, era was already kind of like had receded in esteem by this time, but people were still excited. I mean, they were still playing arenas and I think there was a lot of excitement, at least initially, but yeah, they just could not really get their act together behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, they went on the road. They decided to put the album on ice permanently. And Eddie was just in a bad way throughout this tour. I mean, flubbing solos and forgetting songs. And at one show, he kept tripping over his guitar cable and unplugging it. And some hapless guitar tech had to follow him around the whole show just to make sure he's plugged in. Bad, bad vibes all around. I guess after one show, there was nearly a full-scale brawl backstage. In Sammy's memoirs, a lot of really horrific backstage stories about Eddie flipping out on him. And I guess after one show, Sammy decided to take a shower before heading to their private plane. And that when he got on the plane, Eddie was waiting for him and basically said, "Don't you ever make me fucking wait for you again. Without me, you're nothing. You need me. You'll see. At the end of this tour, you guys will have nothing. You're going to have to call me if you ever want to tour again." Which is quite a thing to say to somebody for taking a shower and making you wait a little bit. Bad vibes on this tour all around, but I know you saw this tour. How was that?
This is the only time I saw Van Halen was on the tour where Eddie Van Halen was fall down drunk and Sammy Hagar was hating everyone in the band. Like, that was the only time I saw them. My memory of it is that it was, like, pretty good. Like, I enjoyed it. I think my standards were probably pretty low because, you know, I'd listened to Van Halen since I was, like, a little kid and I was just excited to see any incarnation of them. A notable thing about this tour as far as Sammy Hagar goes is that he did sing some Roth-era songs on this tour. I remember he did Jump, and he might have done, like, some songs from the first record. So he had definitely loosened up on that by this time. But, you read about this tour, and, like, you have to laugh, even though it is, again, depressing because Eddie Van Halen is such a great musician, and this was, like, a low point for him. There's that story, I think they were playing in Chicago, where he was in the middle of a solo and he stops playing and he says, "Sorry, folks, I've run out of gas." Like, he just stopped like that, which is just incredible. And, you know, he's just drinking a lot. And it sounds like, you know, either because he was drunk or because he was just sick of Sammy Hagar, he was, like, just openly disrespectful to Sammy Hagar. There's that other story where, like, I guess backstage at a show, like, this was toward the end of the tour, he pointed at Sammy's Cabo Wabo tattoo and he said, "That thing ain't gonna last." And then he pointed to, like, his own Van Halen tattoo and he said, "See that? That's better.
That's true.
Going to last longer." Now, it should be noted that, like, Sammy Hagar, he sold, like, a share of his tequila company, the Cabo Wabo Tequila company, for, like, $80 million. Like, he made a ton of money from his tequila company. So, like, the Cabo Wabo tattoo, Eddie Van Halen, you maybe pay some respect to that, to the Cabo Wab. Because, Sammy Hagar made that happen Jimmy Buffett style. But, yeah, this tour was a disaster. And I think, again, like, I think Alex Van Halen was still holding out hope that, like, oh, maybe we can salvage the album.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were barely talking to each other. Sammy and the Van Halens had separate jets, separate hotels, separate limos, even separate security. I mean, it was just completely, they were not on speaking terms at this point. And Sammy just went down to down the Cabo to become a liquor baron, basically, and make his music with the Robaritas.
Yes, a tequila magnate. Now, another notable thing about the 2004 tour is that it was the final tour with Michael Anthony, who, again, we've barely talked about Michael Anthony in our Van Halen episodes because he has rivals with no one. He's a nice guy. He's, like, the nicest guy in Van Halen, and yet he got treated very poorly by the Van Halen brothers. I don't think there's any other way to put it. And he ends up getting kicked out of the band in favor of Wolfgang, Eddie Van Halen's son, who joins the band on the 2007 tour that they ended up doing with David Lee Roth. And Wolfgang Van Halen, he's like, what, like 13, 14 years old at this time. So, talented kid, but somewhat of an insult to Michael Anthony, a charter member of this band, someone who I don't think anyone would call a bass-playing virtuoso, but his backing vocals on Van Halen songs are such a signature part of their sound, and also just his presence on stage. He's always smiling, playing the Jack Daniels bass. For as much darkness and rancor that has existed in this band, it seems like Michael Anthony, in a way, is like the most sort of genuinely party-hardy guy in the band. Like, he's the one that you would want to hang out with the most, I would think. But Eddie Van Halen, like, really, like, went after him in interviews, like, and kind of took away any recognition that he might have had from people. Like, he talked about how, like, he basically would either, like, tell Michael Anthony what to play or, like, play bass himself on a lot of songs. And he even, like, said that, like, you know, those backing vocals you hear on Van Halen records, it's like, I'm singing too. Like, that's as much me as him. So, like, even, like, the backing vocal thing, he couldn't let Michael Anthony have that.
He said he sounds like a piccolo.
It's so sad to me. Yeah, exactly. He said he's got a high voice. Basically saying that, like, he has, like, a piccolo-like voice, and I'm, like, the conductor who's, like, using his voice in a very specific way because that's all it can do. But it's like, he's not really a great singer. Like, I'm as good of a singer as him. It's like, Eddie, come on, man. Like, you already have the name in the band, and you're a guitar-playing genius. We all recognize that. Let Michael Anthony have his backing vocal dap.
Have his one thing, yeah. I mean, and you really, you wonder what actually started this between them. Because apparently it was that Eddie was mad that he was stayed friends with Sammy after the split, which is really weird. Like, when they were on their 2004 reunion tour with Sammy, they didn't want Michael back in the band, and it was part of Sammy's conditions for joining us. We got to get Mike and Anthony back. But it makes no sense. Like, if you're going to bring Sammy back, why are you still mad at this guy for being friends with Sammy? I don't know. It's just, it's the whole like Van Halen brothers, almost like mafia style, us and them, like you're on the outside kind of thing. But I think with Michael, it was really cruel. And all those interviews that Eddie gave where he said like Michael would bring a camcorder over and film Eddie playing bass parts so that he could go home and work on him like a bass tutorial privately is sad. And Sammy took a lot of offense to that too. And he went on his Facebook page and had some video, I think, right after one of Eddie's interviews where he was slacking off Michael, basically saying, like, that's the biggest load of horseshit ever. And also, Michael's a great guy, which I don't think I've ever heard anyone say anything bad about Michael throughout the entire Van Halen saga, which is filled with bad behavior. And you go back to when he joined the band. David Lee Roth joined the band because he rented them a PA set. Michael Anthony joined the band because he gave them a PA set one night when their PA broke down. I think that just shows like what a good heart this guy has in this, you know, in a group that, you know, isn't really known for showing a hell of a lot of loyalty. Big fan of Michael Anthony. He didn't deserve any of that.
Yeah, and the biggest bummer for fans is that they were robbed of like a genuine Van Halen reunion. Like when David Lee Roth came back in the band, Wolfgang was the bass player. And, you know, look, I can appreciate Eddie Van Halen loving his son, wanting to play with his son. And I'm sure it was great for the Van Halen brothers to have like the next generation playing in the band. In much the same way that like their own father, Jan Van Halen, would play with his kids. And it was like, okay, we're passing on this heritage to the next generation. But like you reconcile with Sammy Hagar for a while and Michael Anthony was there and it was great. Then you finally get David Lee Roth back in the band, but it's like, oh, it's still not a full-fledged reunion. We're not going to see the four guys that we remember from the late 70s and early 80s because this kid is there. And it's just so sad that like they couldn't really do that calculus in their head that would say like, okay, well, Wolfgang is young. He's going to have other opportunities. Let's at least do one tour where it's like the four original members. Like how amazing would that have been? It sounds like too that like that might have been in the works like toward the end of Eddie Van Halen's life. Like I think there were rumors in 2019 that they were going to maybe do a tour with Michael Anthony. And then of course, Eddie Van Halen got sick and they couldn't make it happen.
Yeah, I think Michael confirmed that. He said that Irving Azoff called and tried to gauge his interest in doing a big summer tour. But yeah, Eddie's health was on the decline then and it never happened, but that reunion was so close. That would have been incredible.
So, I mean, if the Van Halen brothers are on the outs with Michael Anthony, the nicest man in rock, you know that it was going to be a hard road for them to reconcile with Sammy Hagar, especially after that 2004 reunion tour. And of course, then they subsequently get back together with David Lee Roth. And it just seems like really up until shortly before Eddie Van Halen died, that there was a fair amount of rancor between Sammy Hagar and the Van Halen camp.
Yeah, especially when the Roth album, A Different Kind of Truth, came out. He gave an interview in Rolling Stone where he basically said that Eddie couldn't write songs anymore. He was using old demos from the 70s and 80s for this new album. He said, well, those aren't really songs. And he said, it was always really easy for me to write songs with Ed. He had all these parts and I had all these ideas, but it wasn't like he wrote instrumentals and I just had to write lyrics over them. He said, like, Sammy said that I was an integral part to the writing process in the later years of Van Hagar, too. So, and obviously Eddie was not happy to hear that he could no longer write songs. So they fought in interviews for the next few years until 2016. And that was the year that Prince died, Bowie died, Glenn Frey died. And Sammy said, you know, I really don't want to carry this around with me anymore. So he started sort of tentatively reaching out to try to repair his relationship.
Yeah, I guess like he tweeted at Eddie Van Halen, like, happy birthday. And Eddie wrote back, thanks, Sammy. Hope you're well, too. You know, not exactly overflowing with warmth there.
Cordial.
It's cordial, you know. And I guess Sammy, like, he went on Oprah that summer and he was like talking again about like how he wants to patch things up with Eddie Van Halen and he wants to be friends and not even almost kind of putting like the personal relationship first, really, like in the way he was talking about it. I think he would have loved to have done more musically with Eddie Van Halen. But again, these guys were actually like bros for like a decade, like when they were together. It wasn't like the David Lee Roth thing, which was purely just kind of like a business relationship. Like, I think he felt like, oh, this was a guy I was actually once pretty close to. And now, you know, we've had all this bad blood for a while. And after Eddie Van Halen died, Sammy Hagar talked about how in the final months of Eddie Van Halen's life that they were texting each other on a weekly basis. And it sounds like toward the end that they were finally able to kind of achieve some measure of reconciliation. It sounds like, you know, they weren't as close as they maybe had once been, but they could you know, text regularly the way you would with an old friend and reconnect and hopefully, you know, tell each other what they meant to each other, you know, before Eddie passed.
Yeah, it's really wonderful that they had that.
We're going to take a quick break to get a word from our sponsor before we get to more Rivals.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I don't understand what the big fat ones are. You don't put those inside of you, do you? I mean, you do?
Yes. This is a show about women.
Okay, so I just reapply my lip gloss after eating a delicious lunch. We are headed back now to European Political Systems class at Baruch College. Woo!
Finally, a show about women that isn't just a thinly veiled aspirational nightmare. That's it. That's actually the name of the show. It's not hosted, not narrated. We're just dropping into a woman's world. It's like reality TV on the radio.
I found out when my dad was gay when I was 10. We were in a convertible on the 405 freeway, listening to the B-52s. And looking back, I should have said, this is gay. This is already all gay.
Listen to Finally a Show on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
All right, we've now reached the part of the episode where we give the pro side of each part of the rivalry. Let's talk about Sammy Hagar first. You know, I said this before. I interviewed Sammy Hagar once. This was like in 2011. And I thought he was like a really nice, gregarious guy. And it seems like anecdotally, that for the people who know him, like that's a common takeaway with Sammy Hagar. He's just like this big puppy who wears flip-flops and drinks tequila. You know, like the Spuds McKenzie of singers. And you know, as a singer and songwriter, he is the opposite of like a subtle and artful artist, but he does get the job done. And you can't discount how difficult it was to follow someone like David Lee Roth and how Sammy pulled it off. I mean, just look at the guy who followed Sammy Hagar, Gary Cherone. I mean, they crashed into the side of a mountain with Van Halen 3. So, I mean, I think that speaks to how difficult it was for Sammy Hagar to pull that off. So I feel like when people talk about Van Hagar and they talk about them being this kind of lame, synthy, power ballady, adult contemporary band, Hagar ends up being the scapegoat, which I don't think is totally fair. I mean, obviously, I think his vocal style suited that kind of music more than the party jams of the David Lee Roth era. But again, like, this was music that Eddie Van Halen was writing, and I think it was a direction that he wanted to go in too. So if you don't like those Van Hagar records, Eddie Van Halen must bear the brunt of that responsibility as much as Sammy Hagar. But it must be said, just for the record, that the four albums that they made together all debuted at number one. And they were able to be successful in an era when many bands of their generation had either faded away or broken up. So Sammy Hagar really gave this band a new lease on life and extended their career, maybe even doubled their career, you know, because he was able to make that transition so successfully.
Yeah, I mean, was that definitely the toughest time in a band's life, when they're sort of too young to be classic or a legacy band, but too old to be cutting edge? And like you said, yeah, I think that it gave a built-in excuse for Eddie to sort of rebuild the sound from the ground up. And there you got songs like Don't Tell Me and Pleasure Dome and Seven Seal that, you know, it's interesting. Even if I prefer the earlier Roth stuff, I definitely really appreciate stuff like, you know, even right now, I really like the sort of the more almost prog rocky Journey style stuff that they did do. I don't like it as much as Roth, but it definitely, it's something that I'm grateful exists. And I do feel bad for him, just as like nobody ever likes the Replacement dude. And especially as somebody as amiable as him and as talented as him too. I mean, I think that his voice and his musical skills were a real asset to the group.
Now, if we go over to the pro Van Halen side, I mean, look, in terms of his relationship with Sammy Hagar, deep down, he must have known that the David Lee Roth years were more popular. I mean, Van Halen has two diamond-selling records, and they're both from the Roth era. The self-titled debut in 1984, you know, and while Van Hagar did have those four consecutive number one records, the David Lee Roth years, they sold a lot more albums overall. So when it came time when the possibility to reunite with David Lee Roth arose, and really when they were at the point where they weren't making hits anymore, and they kind of transitioned into that era where they were just going to be a nostalgia act, it made obvious sense to stick with David Lee Roth over Sammy Hagar. And again, also, I don't think Sammy Hagar helped himself by not singing those David Lee Roth hits earlier in their career. I think that if he could have put his own stamp on those songs and at least convinced part of their fan base that, like, oh yeah, he can sing Jump better than David Lee Roth, or he can sing Unchained better than David Lee Roth, I think it would have been harder for Van Halen to pivot back to them. But because he didn't sing those songs, it almost created this scarcity effect where, after 10 years of hearing, you know, Best of Both Worlds and, you know, When It's Love and all these power ballads, people were just hungry for, like, the Van Halen of old. And David Lee Roth was ready to step in. So I think when you look at this band overall, Sammy Hagar, he deserves some credit for helping shepherd Van Halen into this new era. But again, this is ultimately Eddie Van Halen's band. And he knew that Sammy Hagar would work for that late 80s, early 90s era. And then he also knew when to go back to the original guy when it was advantageous to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he was able, just through sheer force of will, to push the band through the split with their lead singer is amazing enough. But then also doing that while navigating the tremendous musical shift of the late 80s and early 90s, that was all Eddie's doing. And I think that's really where he shines in the Van Hagar era, is that you said it basically doubled the band's career by doing that, by creating a whole new sound.
So if you look at these two together, again, I think we've hit upon this, that Eddie Van Halen was able to strike gold again with a much different lead singer. And, you know, as much as, you know, people want to compare Sammy Hagar to David Lee Roth, I actually think it's a good thing that they hired a guy much different than David Lee Roth. If they had hired another, like, motor mouth, like, crazy showman type singer, they would have inevitably fallen short of David Lee Roth. But with a guy like Sammy Hagar, there's really no point in comparing him to David Lee Roth, because they're doing two completely different things. And it allowed Van Halen to really become a different band. Like, when I listen to Van Halen, I really do think of them as two different bands. And I think the Roth era, it's the one I prefer. But there's certain attributes to the Hagar era that don't exist in the Roth era. And I'll say I have a lot of guilty pleasures in the Van Hagar era that I still turn to when I am looking for inspirational synth rock power ballady goodness.
Oh yeah, I mean, Dreams is like, you know, I feel like every time I hear that, I feel like I'm in like an 80s movie with like a like a montage of like working out and like moving towards something. It's definitely, yeah. No, again, two different bands, vastly prefer the Roth, but Van Hagar has some great moments too.
So this concludes our Van Halen series. We've talked about the Van Halens with David Lee Roth. We talked about the Van Halens with Sammy Hagar. At the end, you might just be thinking, why can't this be love between all these people? But
I think by the end it was.
Would you say it was a dream?
It was a dream.
Or multiple, yes, dreams, because it was two different bands? I think it is safe to say that. So thank you all for listening to this episode. We will be back with more beefs and feuds and long-standing resentments next week.
Rivals is a production of iHeartRadio.
The executive producers are Sean Titone and Noel Brown.
The supervising producers are Taylor Chacoin and Tristan McNeil. The producer is Joel Hatstat. I'm Jordan Runtog.
And I'm Stephen Hyden. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.